Technology has made the world a smaller place, but there is still so much we do not know. Every week, Postcards takes you on a trip of exploration and discovery. From a small village in Afghanistan to a protected cultural heritage site in South America. From Africa's amazing natural landscapes to the most advanced tech displays in the world. Postcards, where you meet the world without actually taking a trip. Postcards.
Hello and welcome to Postcards, a show which takes you across borders without actually leaving home. I'm Wen Jie. A food revolution is underway in the Chinatown district of Los Angeles, but it's not your typical fare of egg rolls and chow mein. The area is being rediscovered by a new breed of young chefs lured by cheaper rents and a hip new dining scene. Here's Victor Ning with this postcard from the United States.
Chinatown districts across America have long been known for their traditional architecture, canteen-style eateries, and discount stores. But in downtown Los Angeles, the old Chinese kitchens are being taken over by the next generation of chefs who are serving up a world of new dishes. This kitchen is serving up Nashville fried chicken, while next door you can get fresh Thai food or New Orleans sausages. The only dishes that are becoming harder to find in the Far East Plaza are Chinese. This new wave of eateries follows on from the success of the city's food truck boom. Lower rents and vacant space in Chinatown mean that budding chefs can take their businesses to the next level on a smaller budget. Built in 1979, the Far East Plaza was developed as a Chinese food court, but as those restaurants went out of fashion, many of the kitchens closed down. Today, it is home to a range of eateries, including Howland Ray's, which serves Nashville hot fried chicken with all levels of spice. Also popular is Pok Pok Pad Thai from award-winning chef Andy Ricker, who has had success with similar eateries in Portland and Brooklyn. There's also Amboy Units 120, which serves up Filipino favorites, Little Jewel of New Orleans that serves dishes from the Deep South, and an artisan ice cream shop, Scoops. The area is fast becoming LA's hot new dining destination. Fresh fare is served on the spot with nothing pre-produced, and chefs can be seen cooking and overseeing their kitchens daily. The renewed buzz has also led to a building boom and new markets for residential development. Eddie Kim, senior writer at Los Angeles Downtown News, has been covering the emerging Chinatown development since its inception.
Chinatown is still an emerging market, and while it used to be thriving back several decades ago, right now rents are lower. A lot of people are moving their businesses out, and that basically allows younger professionals who may be on a little bit more of a budget to come in and try a concept that might not work or might be too risky in a market like Santa Monica or Century City or even just mid-city in Los Angeles.
Many businesses in Chinatown are part of the Chinatown Business Improvement District, or BID, which helps businesses and acts as a liaison between them and the government. Shirley Zhang, BID marketing manager, says the influx of newly arrived entrepreneurs has people viewing Chinatown as an emerging hip place to be.
A lot of Chinese businesses moved out in the late 80s and late 90s, and you have all these vacant storefronts that are ready to be restaurants. And when people realize that, hey, they don't have to do a whole renovation to open a restaurant, they can just come to Chinatown and it'll be ready to open in 6 months, they really jumped on that opportunity. And that's why we have all these young chefs with very exciting concepts, but maybe not very large bankrolls. They come to Chinatown because it is so easy for them to open up here and they have such a large interested audience.
Howland Ray's is by far the most popular of the new scene, and it has people queuing all day long for its original Nashville, Tennessee hot fried chicken with 5 levels of hot sauce. Married couple Johnny Zong and Amanda Chapman are the owners and run the kitchen and cash register with military precision. Zong and other chef entrepreneurs say another reason for the boom is Chinatown's history and culture. He says his tiny restaurant is booming because you can't get this kind of chicken anywhere else in the city.
Why there's a line? I mean, Nashville hot chicken is something really beautiful, you know. So L.A. didn't have Nashville hot chicken prior to us opening, and we're like kind of like the one Nashville hot chicken restaurant in Los Angeles at this time, and so it's kind of like the only place to get it.
Derek Moore from commercial real estate firm Avison Young says developers are targeting this area because office space and housing provide attractive returns.
Developers have now found that there is an economic incentive, if you will, for now focusing on Chinatown. Developers had previously really ignored this district of downtown, approximately 15 districts in downtown Los Angeles, with developers really focusing on all areas but Chinatown. Now, with the expansion of the downtown market in general, that we're seeing a diversified demographic, it has now made economic sense.
At Little Jewel of New Orleans, Chef Marcus Christiana Bettinger says younger residents and business owners are gravitating to the area because of the space available.
Downtown is filling up rapidly, and for restaurants, we require space. We need space for diners, we need space for our kitchen. And this neighborhood, it's walkable. People can come down here and spend the day, not just at our restaurant, but at many of the shops. So it's attractive in that sense, and I think people are rediscovering an already interesting neighborhood, honestly.
Those in the area say Chinatown's demographic will continue to change as more housing opens and interesting restaurants continue to sprout. A once-tired neighborhood being reborn as a multinational community open for all.
Everywhere you look today, China is in the news. But what about the lives behind the stories? How do ordinary Chinese live and work? And does everyone here do kung fu? Life in China answers the questions in your mind when you think of China. Over a billion people and as many stories from all over this vast land. Life in China, bringing you all you need to know about the real Chinese living here in China.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. A native bush plum that grows in the wild in Australia is to be marketed globally because it is rich in natural vitamin C. The Kakadu plum is collected by women from a remote indigenous Northern Territory community. But biopiracy is putting pressure on their industry. Here's Doris Wan with this postcard from Australia.
It's dry season in the remote Northern Territory community of Wadai, about 240 kilometers southwest of Darwin. These women are on a mission to collect traditional bush food that's now coming into harvest. Over the next few weeks, around 200 women and children will forage for Kakadu plums. They grow in abundance after the wet season in tropical Australia. The wild fruit is cherished in traditional Aboriginal medicine for its healing properties. Maureen Simon is a local Indigenous ranger.
For your headache, if we have headache at bush, we eat plum, it makes us feel good.
While Indigenous people have known its value for centuries, the plant is fast becoming a hot ticket item in the Western world. Powdered plum now sells for around $500 per kilogram. In 2013, the women of Wadai purchased a Sydney-based business that was already harvesting Kakadu plums. Part of the transaction included a patent over processing, technology, and machinery. Margot Northey is the general manager of Wadai Women's Center.
The women loved the idea. It was doing something that they loved to do out on country, so they looked at it, they thought about it, they owned the local takeaway and had some money in the bank.
The whole process of harvesting has become a community effort along with the growing demand for the plums. There's increasing commercial interest in the plums after they were found to act as a natural preservative, extending the shelf life of prawns. Yasmina Saltenbauer from the University of Queensland led the research into the plums.
So 2014, we dipped about $10 million worth of prawns, and last year, $12.5 million.
There are 24,000 known native foods in Australia. But the intellectual property of bush foods is being largely exploited by what some are calling biopiracy. Companies and individuals can patent the intellectual property associated with native plant knowledge, meaning others can't use it for 20 years. Daniel Robinson is from the University of Sydney.
We found more than 100, about 150, that relate to endemic plant species, so that are clearly utilizing plants that are found in Australia.
The bush plum has several patents for its processing technique, one of which the Wadai people own, but several others are with U.S. companies. There is no priority given to indigenous people. Anyone, including big companies, can currently put in place patents on processing bush foods, making it difficult for indigenous people to commercialize them. Joel Morrison is the CEO of the Northern Land Council, an indigenous lobby group.
And I think the government should really put a moratorium on allowing further patents to be registered and executed in Australia when it comes to the use of native plants and other products here in Australia, and allow Aboriginal people to get a foothold in relation to using their intellectual knowledge.
But it's come too late for groups like the Wadai women. A Darwin-based caterer, Karen Sheldon, says she believes other countries are already growing the plums.
We've been told that there's already plantations being started in Indonesia, and we think it won't be long before, just like the macadamia nut story, that the Kakadu plum story will be lost to Australia.
In 1882, native macadamia seeds were taken from Australia to Hawaii. In the 1920s, the U.S. established a macadamia nut industry, despite the nuts being a native Australian food. It took Australia 30 years to catch up to production levels. Currently, demand for bush plums outweighs supply across northern Australia. Just 20 tons are harvested from the wild. Orchards and enrichment planting are both methods which could increase the scale of the industry. The Wadai women have established a nursery to cultivate trees for future plantations. But they're still yet to fully exploit the native trees, which grow in abundance.
The yield here is quite extraordinary. There are huge numbers of trees here. We put in an application for a permit to take up to 10 tonnes this year. I'm told by experts that that's either 0.01 or even 0.001 of a percent of what's here in this region.
What started as a small niche industry looks like it's about to bear even more fruit for the indigenous communities of northern Australia.
A chance to hear what's new in China with local news, topical reports, lighthearted stories, and travel. It's China Horizons. Check out the changes sweeping China's provinces and explore the fascinating natural and man-made beauty of this ancient country. Plus the culture, customs, and history of the nation's 55 minority groups. It's China Horizons.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. The reopening of the World Trade Center Mall in New York is set to transform shopping in Manhattan. Shops, from Apple to Longings, will serve an increasingly diverse group of residents in addition to Wall Street bankers. But they'll also be catering to tourists who come to visit the National September 11th Memorial and Museum. Here's Spencer Music with this postcard from the United States.
Overlooked by the white spires of the new World Trade Center, the first 60 of more than 100 stores in the new Westfield Shopping Mall have opened their doors to shoppers. The 365,000-square-foot center stretches along a four-block underground network that spans the bases of three office towers. While mostly below street level, light beams in through the windows of the Santiago Calatrava-designed winged oculus that tops the transportation hub of 13 subway trains and river ferries. More than 300,000 commuters use it on a daily basis. The mall is packed with people wanting to shop or just feeling excited to see the new center.
I think it's absolutely amazing. I love the way they've transformed it. I think it brings tourism back over into this area, and I love it.
I just think that the rebuilding of the site is great for this community, and we've waited a long time for the site to come up to this level.
Yeah, I think it makes you feel safe again. There's attraction, there's malls, there's restaurants. It brings a happy aura back to the World Trade Center.
Westfield says 15 million travelers are expected to visit the area from the U.S. and around the world next year to see the memorial and nearby places of interest. More than 60,000 residents live within blocks of the World Trade Center area, about three times the number of just before September 11th. Workers now include a slew of advertising and media employees, as well as people working in finance. Experts say the former shopping mall was once one of the most successful properties in the world, and retailers hope the new mall will be even more successful. For many, the mall symbolizes the progress made in rebuilding and revitalizing the area since the September 11th attacks.
You know, it really, really means a big impact for the community, for everything around us. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, why not have something like this out here and help the community?
I thought of that today. As I came here, I'm walking down the street, I see the new World Trade Center, and I see, you know, the white spires coming out. And I'm old enough to remember when, you know, the building was almost built. Okay, I'm almost 50. And I actually went to the top of the World Trade Center on my 30th birthday. So I'm still nostalgic for you what used to be there. And then to see, like, all this new stuff, like, after all the destruction that's happened, I think it's meaningful, believe me.
The remaining 40 stores in the center are due to open in time for the winter holiday season.
The Beijing Hour brings you 60 minutes of comprehensive news and information from China and the rest of the world. We help you through the day with a mix of news, sports, and entertainment. We also bring you in-depth analysis of the day's big stories, as well as the closing numbers from the global market. The Beijing Hour, your very own window on China and the world. Join us here on The Beijing Hour. Let's take a look at the world together.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. Africa is establishing itself as a hot destination for people who want to feel an adrenaline rush on their holidays. Adventure tourism is bringing thousands of visitors to Zambia every year, where people can do everything from rafting the Zambezi River to bungee jumping at Victoria Falls. Before we come to the end of today's show, I would like to share with you an extra postcard from Zambia. South African tourist Simone Bishop is getting ready for the ride of her life. She's about to fly over what is considered by many to be one of the seven natural wonders of the world. The microlight journey will give her a bird's-eye view of the spectacular Victoria Falls in Zambia. Pilot Grant Welch from Batoka Microlight says the rainy season is the best time to fly.
The high season for me is the better part because you get the sheer might of the Victoria Falls with all the water. And also there's a huge plume of spray that comes up over the falls, beautiful to see, and experience that you can still feel the spray against your body from the microlight because it's nice and open, and the views from the falls is completely uninterrupted.
Victoria Falls, which lies on the Zimbabwe-Zambia border, is known locally as the smoke that thunders. The rising mist is visible 10 to 20 kilometers away. The microlight cruises at 95 kilometers an hour. Nervous passengers can be rest assured that in the unlikely event of engine failure, the microlight can safely glide and land. Bishop finds the experience thrilling.
It was only after we'd passed the falls and come back the second time that I was sort of brave enough to kind of look over the falls. But I don't have a fear of heights, and yet when you're up there, it's almost impossible not to feel the fear of heights. So I would say that is a proper adrenaline rush moment for sure. Anyone who wants to get the blood flowing, hop on a microlight. Amazing thing to do.
Microlighting is one of the suite of extreme activities on offer at Victoria Falls. Alexander Mutali is chairman of the Livingstone Tourism Association, which represents the tourism sector in Livingstone, Zambia. He says the area has a well-established reputation among adrenaline junkies.
Visitors to Victoria Falls can spend 4 full days or more just doing adrenaline sports. There's so much on offer, and it's well established. A lot of the activities have been on offer since the 1980s. It's also a really beautiful area with so much natural beauty.
Victoria Falls Bridge lies not far from the falls. The colonialists who constructed the bridge in 1905 probably never imagined people would be jumping off it for fun. American tourist Tina Holcroft-Fishlin got strapped in to leap off the 111-meter bridge.
I'm anxious. I'm ready to fall into the abyss and just enjoy the view on the way down and hopefully back up.
All right, 4, 3, 2, 1, bungee!
A latex bungee cord attached to Holcroft-Fishlin's ankles ensures she'll bounce back from her jump. The cord stretches as she plummets to the Zambezi River at 120 kilometers an hour. The free fall lasts 4 seconds. Holcroft-Fishlin describes the sensation.
Wow, truly amazing. And to have the mist from the falls, when you first go off, it's like, wow. And then once you hit the first drop, you relax. And I was so relaxed and just enjoying the fresh, clean, beautiful scenery in the air. It was an amazing adrenaline rush.
Other activities of Victoria Falls Bridge include abseiling and a 240-meter zip line from one end of the gorge to the bridge. New Zealand tourists Kate Duffy and Molly Leiters gear up for whitewater rafting, another Victoria Falls sport. Downstream lies the zigzag gorge carved out over millennia by the Zambezi River. J.C. Stein of Bundu Adventures explains the experience.
You'll feel alive at the end of it. The rapids are big, probably the most extreme whitewater rafting in the world. We have incredible safety record, all companies on the Zambezi, and we guarantee to give you a ride of your life.
Today's rafting trip will negotiate 15 rapids. Before each rapid, Stein gives a pep talk to the rafters on what line to take through the gushing waters. There's also time between the rapids to take in the beauty of the Zambezi Gorge. Leiters and Duffy both enjoy the experience.
I was quite nervous, didn't really want to do it, but Kate made me. And then after a while, after we first got in the water, it was quite fun. I relaxed a bit after that. On the big waves, I thought my life was over, but we got through.
Once we learnt what I was doing and everything, the adrenaline all kicked in when the big waves came in. Yeah, it was really awesome. And the swimming was heaps of fun too.
Victoria Falls is a major African extreme sport hub that is also a gateway to wildlife viewing in reserves and parks in the area. With that, we wrap up today's postcards. Your comments, suggestions, or questions are always appreciated. And you can contact us via email at postcards@cri.com.cn. For program producer Zhao Jianfu, I'm Wen Jie. See you next week.